response to this question. Please elaborate on your credentials. How have your education, knowledge, values, characteristics, life experiences, and personal challenges prepared you and qualified you to serve in the U.S. Congress? We begin with Representative Noem.
Well, thank you, Jack, and thank you to the Sioux Falls Rotary for hosting this debate today. I appreciate Paula coming and being a part of the discussion, and everyone who's attending, and those watching online. We've got a lot of interesting things to discuss, and it sounds like a lot of topics to cover. I think most of you know a lot about me already. I'm a lifelong farmer and rancher, run several small businesses, had a hunting lodge, a restaurant, an insurance agency that my husband runs. I have a husband and three kids. Two of my girls are here. Cassidy and Kennedy are here today. Booker is not. He's at football practice, so apparently it's a big deal if you miss football practice, so he's there. And, you know, I just really think that as I look at my family and watch my kids chase the opportunities that we have in this country, when I talk to small business owners who are being innovative and trying new things, when I talk to families across South Dakota at 4-H events, at church, at sporting events, I'm encouraged. And when I visit, even with my grandma, who reminded me that we lived through World War II and Jimmy Carter, she tells me that we have been through hard stuff before. And that's encouraging to me because, really, there's a lot of dysfunction in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of things that are discouraging for me. So I've worked hard to keep a level head and try to accomplish things in a bipartisan manner for the state of South Dakota. And we've had some real wins. We got a fully funded 5-year infrastructure bill that took care of a lot of South Dakota's need. We reauthorized an education program that gave more flexibility back to the states and also mandated, said that the federal government could not mandate Common Core standards. We've held the IRS's feet to the fire. We've funded our military. We've also made sure that we've gotten things accomplished when it came to human trafficking and protecting our children. But we've got challenges. We need to have growth in this country. We've got to focus on tax reform, relief from regulations, making sure that we can deal with Obamacare and trying to repeal it and put you back in charge of your health care decisions, and that's what I'm focused on. I think we'll have a really interesting discussion here today. You're going to hear about two different visions for this country, and I want to thank you, Jack, for hosting us.
Thank you. Representative Hawks.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you so much to the Sioux Falls Rotary for hosting this event. It's great to be able to be here to discuss these issues that we're going to be facing in the next legislative session in Congress. As far as my background, I grew up on a farm outside of Flandreau with my siblings and my parents, a small family farm. We did everything from raising animals to raising crops, and that was all part of what I grew up with and what has shaped my philosophy and the foundation of what I believe in and what I strive to achieve. In my adult life, I am married to Steve. He's here with me today. We have three beautiful children who are doing their various activities today as well. I spent 10 years as a teacher in the West Central High School. I also served there as a representative for the teachers in negotiations and salaries and contract language and that kind of information that helped me drive myself into interest in the political world and is what drove me ultimately to run for the legislature in 2012. And I won that seat and have been representing District 9 in the state legislature for the last 4 years. And going into the legislature, I went there because I was sick and tired of a bunch of people with no education experience lecturing me about education policy. And so I went there to be the voice for education and be the voice for those folks actually working in the industry. And going there, it was obvious to me that I had to work in a bipartisan nature. It is impossible to go to peer as a Democrat and not work with the Republicans who are our representatives there as well. My first piece of legislation was co-sponsored by the majority leader in the Senate, and we worked together to pass great education reforms. And I continued those relationships through to my last year, where we worked to pass one of the best education reforms in the state of South Dakota history. And so I will carry that forward as I represent South Dakota and its interests in the U.S. House.
We now are going to go to a series of questions that will call for 1-minute responses to these questions. Congress and Washington frequently are described as dysfunctional and broken. One of you already has called it dysfunctional. As one of 435 representatives, how will you contribute to the legislative process, to constructive debate, to civility, and compromise for the good and the advancement of our state and nation? We begin with Representative Noem.
Well, one of the things I learned very quickly when I got to Washington, D.C., working on the farm bill, was the need for South Dakota's representative to be louder. Many of the states, because of population, they have 40 to 50 members. We get one. That means when something's important to our state, we have to work harder and visit every single member in their office to make sure they're educated on the policies that we're working on. And I have consistently done that, and I've also reached across the aisle. In fact, the majority of my bills that I sponsor are bipartisan in nature. I think that when you come from a state like we are, you have to make sure that you focus on coalitions on different issues with different individuals. I might not agree with an individual in Washington, D.C. on 80% of the issues, but I can still work with them on 20% of the others. And that's what we really need to get things done for South Dakota. We did that by getting a great farm bill that I was a lead negotiator on. We did it by getting human trafficking legislation. I'm even the chairwoman of the Bipartisan Women's Caucus.
Representative Hawks.
Okay. Thank you. I think that having gone into the state legislature as a basically an endangered species in South Dakota, you know, we're outnumbered 4-1 in Pierre. And so going there with the expectation of being able to do anything without having a bipartisan support is folly. And so knowing that, I went there to develop relationships, one conversation, one person at a time. And I went immediately across the aisle because those are the folks that I needed to work with and be able to have those conversations with and find those key issues that we could agree on. Again, knowing that we aren't going to agree on everything, but that is absolutely no reason to try not to try to find those issues that you can come together on. And so we did that. I did that from day one, walking across the aisle, talking to folks that I knew I could find common ground with, developing those relationships and being able to work with them. And that's what we need in Washington, and that's what we're missing right now. And we all agree, it's broken. It's a broken system. And we have to stop digging in our heels and start working together to find common ground to move this country forward.
Next question. In a few sentences, maybe reflecting upon what is said in our United States Constitution, please summarize what you see as the proper role, parameters, and function of the United States federal government. Christine Ohm.
Jack, I think that's a phenomenal question because really this is the debate that we have oftentimes between parties. And I truly believe that my position is that the federal government's role should be very small. It's not the answer to everything. The number one responsibility of our federal government is to keep us safe and provide for our national security. That's why you'll see and you've seen in the past me arguing to adequately equip and train our military men and women. They step up and defend us so that we can sleep safely in our beds at nights. And this administration has consistently cut their training dollars, consistently cut the resources they have ability to use to keep us safe, and has weakened our position on the world stage. So I truly believe that the number one responsibility of the federal government is to keep us safe, and beyond that, it should be a very small role in our life.
Paula Hawks.
Thank you, Jack. You're going to find that as we go through this debate today, you're going to see that there are some issues where Christy and I agree wholeheartedly. And I do agree that the federal government needs to be small and that we need to make sure that the states are granted the rights that they have and that they are allowed to carry forth with the responsibilities that they have and that the federal government should stay out of that as much as possible. And what I do believe for the federal government role is exactly what she said. Provide security. That comes in a few different forms, not just in the military form, but in also providing for leadership in terms of infrastructure security, making sure that we are able to provide the incentives and jobs for growth in the economy, in not just in South Dakota, but across the country, that we protect our economic interests as well as our military interests across this world, and making sure that we are key in leadership in making sure that those responsibilities are met.
Next question. The national debt is approaching $20 trillion. Because of deficit spending, the debt grew by about $450 billion last year alone. Would you and how would you address the budget deficit? Christy Noem.
Well, for me, and I want you to understand, when I talk about this issue, for me it's a moral issue because we are currently spending money on programs that our people are benefiting from, but we're not paying for them. We're asking our children and grandchildren to pay for them because we continue to deficit spend. So since I've been in Washington, D.C., I've voted for over $6 trillion worth of spending cuts because I think that we have to follow the example of the South Dakota people. We don't have families here that live above their means for years and years and years. They make tough decisions and they tighten their belts. And so I believe that what I need to do is constantly check an administration that's trying to spend more and more money on programs. In fact, our president even threatened to veto our National Defense Authorization Act in order to get more domestic spending. I disagree with that. I think we have to focus on our priorities, tighten our belt, make tough decisions, and because of that, the check that the Republicans have provided has allowed us to get over $887 billion of reduction in spending. I think that's important, especially when you look at our debt continue to climb.
Paula Hawks.
When we talk about the national debt and how we control spending, I think that we need to look at it from a needs-based perspective. What is it that we need to provide, and how do we meet those needs? And then we need to look at it from a perspective of how do we meet those needs while still looking at the programs that are in place and deciding what is absolutely necessary and what can be cut. And when we look at that, we need to first stop the automatic reauthorization of programs. We don't do that in South Dakota. We take a look at everything. We take a look at what is actually performing at its expectation. If it's not, we cut that program. That's how we balance our budget. We need to take that approach from a national perspective as well. What is it that we need to do? What is working? What isn't working? And how do we prevent it from being a drain on our resources if it's not working? The only way we do that is by checking it from the beginning, taking a look at it every time we rewrite the budget, and making sure that it is doing what it was intended to do. And if not, eliminate it.
Let's take a deeper look now into revenue and expenses, beginning first with tax policy. What changes do you favor in the federal tax code, its provisions and policies, both for individuals and corporations? Christy Noem.
Well, my story is that tax policy is one of the reasons I'm involved in government and politics. It's because when I was in college, my dad was killed in an accident on our farm. And when I came home to become the general manager of that operation, I got hit with the death taxes. And it was a very detrimental situation for my family. We had to take out a loan for 10 years to pay off those taxes. And so that's why I got involved in government and politics. I am working and have put forward a proposal on tax reform that is one of the largest packages of reforms that we've seen in decades. In fact, if it were enacted and signed into law, the majority of Americans could pay their taxes on a postcard. Now remember, we spend $160 billion a year helping people help us paying them to make sure we pay our taxes correctly. $6 billion or 6 billion hours are spent people paying their taxes. This would lower rates for everybody. It would lower rates for small businesses, for corporations, encouraging them to stay in our country, and for individuals, and make sure that it was a much simpler process with fewer exemptions and incentivizing the right things.
Paula Hawks.
You know, as I cross the state and talk to folks across South Dakota about what their major concerns are, they aren't concerned about the complexity of the tax code. What they are concerned about is everybody paying their fair share. And they don't feel like the government is representing them in that sense. When they are looking at tax cuts that benefit corporations and billionaires across the country instead of the middle class folks who live here in South Dakota, they experience a great deal of distrust for the process. What people want is to know that they are being represented and that they are going to see everybody paying their fair share. What we need are tax incentives for the middle class. What we need are tax incentives for Main Street businesses, small businesses in South Dakota who are trying to get going, who are trying to hire people and experience economic growth, not Wall Street billionaires. The Wall Street billionaires are taking good care of themselves. Who we need to help are the average middle-class South Dakotans who live right here.
Spending. The federal government, serving a nation now of about 320 million people, spends $4 trillion a year in its spending budget. In broad terms, what should change and what should remain the same in federal spending? Christy Noem.
Well, when you look at federal government spending, what I get the opportunity to vote on every single year is discretionary spending. That's about a third of what the federal government spends each and every year. Most people don't know that two-thirds of our federal government spending is on autopilot. It gets kicked out the door year after year, day after day, without Congress ever voting on it. And that's things like Social Security, Medicare, entitlement programs, poverty programs. Many of them are on automatic. At some point in time, somebody put a formula in law that makes sure that that happens. The third that I vote on happens in the appropriations process. And we work to make sure that through that deliberation, that the priorities of this country are funded. But the biggest way and the best way to make sure that our country is going to be in a stable fiscal situation is to look at those programs and save them for the future. I'm very concerned that all economics and projections tell us that Social Security and Medicare will be bankrupt within 8 to 10 years. They have to be shored up so that people who are counting on those programs can count on them and still have them to benefit from in years to come.
Paula Hawks.
Obviously, federal spending does need some looking at, and we do need to take a look at what programs need to stay in place. And again, like I said before, we need to take a look at what we need and how we finance what we need. And Christy mentioned the autopilot. I agree. We need to take those programs off of autopilot, look at the ones that are working, keep them in place because they are working for us, and eliminate those programs or shore down those programs that aren't working and put them into some kind of check and balance so that they aren't automatically getting the money that they're not using effectively. We also need to make sure that we are properly funding those needs that we have, including military spending. It has to be something that we maintain so that we can protect our national security. We also need to take a look at what we have promised the folks of this country. And when we talk about programs like Medicare and Social Security, we need to make sure that people can feel secure in those retirement planning programs that they've been promised. And so we'll need to take a look at how we budget for those and how we take care of the needs of this country.
Well, let's do that right now. Two-thirds of the budget, as you both say, is on automatic pilot. That is, two-thirds of the budget either goes to pay interest on the national debt or it goes to entitlement programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and food stamps. What, if any, changes would you make in the funding of those entitlements, in benefit payments, and in benefit eligibility? Representative Noem.
Well, first of all, most of the South Dakotans that I talk to that pay into Social Security and Medicare are offended that we call them entitlements because they pay into them. And that's something that they've paid into for many, many years, and they're anticipating and counting on that benefit being there when they retire. The fact is we need growth in this country, and the tax reform package that I put forward would give us a 9.1% growth. The problem we have is workers have left the workforce. They're not paying into Social Security and Medicare. So instead of paying into those programs, they're drawing out. Back in the 1950s and 60s, we had 16 workers paying into those programs for every single person that was taking money out. Now we're down to three workers paying in, and healthcare costs have gone up, so we're draining it faster because healthcare costs have gone up. Less people paying in, the baby boomers are all retiring and taking out of that program, and the best way to fix this situation is to get our economic growth going, and we're not going to make that happen until we're competitive in our international tax reform package that we have, and that we're also working to make sure that we get rid of these regulations that are stifling our businesses.
Thank you. Paula Hawks.
Again, we're going to see a place where we agree. Social Security and Medicare are not entitlement programs. They have been paid into, and so we need to protect those programs for the folks who are counting on those for retirement security. When we talk about tax reform, we also need to consider that we are talking about a country made up of a majority of middle-class folks who are trying to make it in small business, trying to make it as farmers and ranchers, and who are not seeing the benefits of a tax reform policy that we're hoping for. The tax reform policy that we are looking at right now is going to benefit the top 1%. 96% of those benefits go to the top 1%. And so when we talk about stimulating the economy, we need to talk about the folks who actually do stimulate the economy, the folks that when they get a few extra dollars in their pocket, spend that money, put it out into the local economy of which they are a part. And so we need to be balancing our preferences and our policies to make sure that we are putting that where it can do the most good.
Well, let's take a further look at that. What will it take to stimulate this virtually stagnant economy of ours? And between the tax policy that you may advocate, the federal spending policy you may advocate, as well as other shifting priorities, Representative Noem, what is it that's going to turn this economy around and get it moving forward?
Well, the regulatory environment under this administration has been unlike anything that we've ever seen before. In fact, President Obama's administration has put out over 3,600 major regulations. They have also resulted in 79,000 pages of regulations. And it would drive up to an average family in South Dakota the consumer price index of $11,000 per family. When you talk about raising prices on things like microwaves and fluorescent light bulbs and things like that for families that have to purchase these items, they need a break. They don't need costs going up and food costs going up and electricity costs going up, which would happen under President Obama's clean power plan. They need these regulatory burdens to be relieved so that we can become more competitive, see the kind of growth that we need and create the jobs that we need so they can have better paying jobs in the long run.
When we talk about tax policy, we talk about spending, we talk about the federal deficit, we are talking about how we treat our middle class because they are the major stimulants for that growth. When we talk about small businesses and we talk about family farmers here in South Dakota, we are looking at how we can stimulate that growth, and that includes tax incentives for small business people in South Dakota. I've seen that, in getting the capital, securing the capital to start a small business is very difficult in this economic situation, and that's where we can find ways to open up those capital opportunities for folks in South Dakota who are wanting to be entrepreneurs, wanting to open up that job market, create growth here in South Dakota. We also can be looking at protections in the workplace, ways that we can incentivize people to go to work and stay in work, and that would include helping them in times of controversy or times of problems in their personal lives. Things like sick leave, things like paid child leave, things that are going to help not just the employees but also the employers when you talk in terms of maintaining and helping your workforce stay strong.
What is the answer? How do we create more better paying jobs in this country? Current federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. What should the minimum wage be? What would you do to stimulate better paying jobs? Congressman Noem.
Well, to get better paying jobs, you need small businesses, because small businesses create the jobs in this country, the vast majority of them. And you need to give them an opportunity where they can be profitable so they can reinvest and expand in their business and hire more workers and pay their workers more. I think you'll see the integrity among small businesses and doing exactly that. As soon as they get excess profits, they will expand, take care of their employees, and make sure that they are making a higher wage. So I truly believe that what they need is a tax code that works for them, which in our proposal we laid out. We lowered the rate for small businesses down to 25% so they could compete, so they could keep more money in their business and reinvest and expand.
And what do you think should be the minimum wage?
The minimum wage in South Dakota is $8.55.
But what should be the federal minimum wage?
Well, I believe that those decisions are made best in the state. I mean, we're nothing like California. I mean, our cost of living's not the same. So we're very different across the country. To set a federal minimum wage, I think, is not the accurate way to approach it. And the best thing you can do as far as raising wages is to make sure that these small businesses are successful and they will pay their employees more.
Representative Hawks.
I would agree that expanding small businesses is a likely opportunity for bringing better wages and better jobs into South Dakota. One proposal that I have put out there that I've talked about during this campaign is the expanding energy market in South Dakota and how we can bring in wonderful, high-paying, high-tech jobs into South Dakota by expanding our portfolio in energy. We have already expanded that portfolio in terms of ethanol production. We can expand that even further. We can also open up the industries of wind and solar, and that brings in incredible high-paying jobs that are technical that folks want, that young people are going to school for but can't find those jobs in South Dakota, and so they're leaving. We can bring them back, we can attract them back to South Dakota by opening up those opportunities for them. And in terms of the minimum wage, yeah, South Dakota made a valiant step in raising the minimum wage. I would agree that setting a federal minimum wage is a dangerous situation because, frankly, we are different from California or New York, and we have to play to those differences and make sure that we're doing what we can for those in those areas.
Please explain your platform regarding U.S. military and foreign policy, particularly as it relates to the Middle East, the threat from ISIS, and the humanitarian crisis in Aleppo, Syria. Christy Noem.
Well, first of all, we need to continue to support Israel, and I think this administration's been all over the map on that. It's a democracy in the Middle East, and they have been an ally of the United States, and we need to continue to maintain that relationship. That's why I've been glad to see certain agreements come to completion. And whatever we can do to rely less on the Middle East for our energy policy is critically important. That's why I support an all-of-the-above American energy supply. But we see hot places and dangerous situations all over the world today. It's not just the Middle East that's on fire. We also have North Korea. Russia is a grave concern for this country right now. Iran is a tragic situation. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so concerned about our military and making sure that they're adequately funded and trained. Because we can maybe respond to one hot spot in the country, maybe need to be concerned about Iran and be concerned about protecting Israel and making sure that we have our investments secured there, but also we do not have the resources to respond to hot spots all over the world and fight ISIS at the same time.
Paula Hawks.
In terms of ISIS, I believe that we need to continue our policy of finding them and eliminating them wherever they exist. We need to eliminate those hot pockets wherever they are. We're having some great successes in terms of finding those and eliminating them. Fallujah has been a great success. We are looking at retaking Mosul. And that's eliminating those leadership places where the state of ISIS is strong and rebuilds itself every time that we bring an offensive against them. Of utmost importance is working with our allies in those regions so that we can bring back regional stability. Because with that regional stability comes some confidence and the ability to rebuild and rebuild their strength and their identity of their region. And right now, the ISIS state is taking advantage of that regional instability to build themselves, to be attractive to folks who have no other options or feel they have no other options. And here at home, we can attack that by taking control of the social media making it attractive here.
Thank you. How do you rate the strength and readiness of the United States military, and are we providing adequate resources in terms of funding? Christy Noem.
I believe our military is outstanding. And it seems like whatever challenge we send there, they respond with excellence, and they do their job, and they don't quit. Oftentimes, I think members of Congress and the administration have quit on them, and that's unfortunate. When you see the United States Congress and the president argue over budgets and pass a CR, what that does to our military is devastating. That's why we need to do appropriation bills, make sure we get a National Defense Authorization Act bill done every single year. When it's threatened from the administration that they'll veto that in order to get more domestic spending is not patriotic. It's not taking care of the men and women who keep us safe. So I do believe they need more resources. I have fought in our budget negotiations the last several years to get more resources and more dollars to our military. We are stretching them beyond what they've been stretched before in the past. And in many instances, other countries have more weapons and missiles available to them than what the United States does. We are not necessarily the best armed country in the world anymore. And for me, that's not where we want to be.
Paula Hawks.
I believe that the United States has the strongest and best trained military in the world, and we continue to show our strength when it is necessary. And we are here to back up our allies, we are here to protect our national security, and that's of utmost importance. Maintaining that funding, improving those resources that are necessary and essential for them to do their jobs is, of course, of utmost importance. Here in South Dakota, I think it's very important to protect our interests in the military, particularly with Ellsworth Air Force Base, continuing to protect its interests and protect its relationship with the military and with South Dakota. It's a huge job provider, but it's also a huge influence in military action in terms of what we provide. And expanding that with the new programs that are coming into South Dakota, I'm very excited about those, and I continue to support those decisions that are being made to help us be a part of that presence.
We've hit just about the halfway mark, so we're going to reverse the order of the speakers. So Paula Hawks will go first, and Christy Noem second for the remainder of this exchange. What is your platform on U.S. energy policy? And please address how that ties to national security and to environmental issues such as pollution, global warming, fracking, and the transportation of crude oil by rail and pipelines. Paula Hawks.
60 seconds, really, Jack? Goodness.
Okay, we'll go 2 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
We'll go 2 minutes.
I was gonna say, I'm going to have to speed talk.
Go 2 minutes on this.
Thank you, Jack, for being reasonable on that. I've touched a little bit on what I think about energy policy, particularly in South Dakota, but I think, as has been mentioned before, it does need to be an all-of-the-above approach. We see in South Dakota that our energy cooperatives are broadening their policies in terms of what they are using for energy production, and I think that we can continue to expand upon that. One of the biggest holdups that we have for our energy situation in this country is our grid. And modernizing that grid has to be at the top of our priorities for energy production. It needs to be modernized beyond what it's been doing for the last 150 or so years. It hasn't changed much. However, the energy production landscape has changed a great deal. We now have renewable energy resources that are being produced on a wide scale across the country and a grid that is not ready to support that. And so when we talk about modernizing the grid, we have to be ready to accept those forms of energy production in. We are not going to move away from fossil fuels tomorrow or next week. And we have to be prepared to work our way away from that, maintaining that energy independence that we have achieved and making sure that we're ready for the future. And that includes solar and wind and ethanol production and all of those other resources that we have such a great opportunity to mine here in South Dakota. And not only does that help with energy production, it also helps with job creation, as I mentioned before. In terms of national security, it is a grave concern when our grid has not been modernized to the point that it can handle what is coming its way. And so cybersecurity is of vast importance, and that's where we need the educational resources to pump up our ability to defend ourselves against those attacks that come in the form of energy grid attacks. And that's another opportunity for us to expand not only our energy production, but also our jobs and economic development.
Thank you. Christine, you want me to repeat that question?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Just because I hope you all understand how important the energy issue is in South Dakota. We spend, the average family in this state making $50,000 per year spends $15,000 of that on energy. It's double the national average. So when the administration comes out with a policy that hits energy production, like Obama's Clean Power Plan regulation that he came out with and proposed for existing coal-fired power plants, it hits us twice as hard. In fact, the president even said that this would necessarily skyrocket costs to people in the country in order to be environmentally conscious. And so that's my biggest concern, is protecting our part of the world where we depend so much on energy. It's frankly, it's a long ways to drive anywhere. It gets cold in the winter, it's hot in the summer. We just rely heavily on energy, and we rely heavily on coal-fired energy plants. And so when regulations that come out and target those existing plants, that's concerning to me. So I'm focused on making sure that we not only have an all-of-the-above energy supply here, and we focus on American energy supply, on ethanol, biodiesel, wind, making sure that our products, our petroleum products are accessible, but also that the regulatory environment isn't driving up costs for consumers as well, considering the burden that we already have going on here in South Dakota. Now, ethanol does not have a tax credit anymore. It also has a renewable fuel standard, but we need relief from the EPA on the reed vapor pressure issue, and that's something you're going to hear me talk a lot about. Is it's going to make sure we can keep ethanol at the consumer pump, so it's available to them on a longer period year-round, so we can use more ethanol. That's something that's good for our state, for our agriculture economy, but it also is a renewable fuel we can grow right here so we can get less resources from the Middle East. That's the kind of common sense that we need coming out of the federal government. Right now, we're just not seeing it out of the EPA or out of the Obama administration.
We continue letting Paula Hawks go first here. Please explain your platform regarding federal health care policy, Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. 1 minute. I'm sorry, we're back to 1 minute. We're back to 1 minute.
That is a big topic. Obviously, when we talk about the Affordable Care Act, it's a controversial issue. And I would agree that there are some issues with Obamacare, and there are some things that we can do to improve upon that program. Throwing it out without an option for replacement is not a good approach. A couple of things that I think can be done in terms of improving Obamacare. Number one, we can allow Medicare, the largest purchaser of pharmaceutical drugs to negotiate those prices with pharmaceutical companies. Number two, we crack down on those pharmaceutical companies who are raising prices for no reason, like EpiPen. Number three, we can allow folks to shop for insurance across state lines. Competition is always a good thing. And number four, one of the things that we can do in South Dakota, and we've talked to a great extent, that brings down costs for everybody is expand Medicaid. In states where Medicaid has been expanded, premium prices are 7% cheaper.
Kristi Noem.
Well, I think you all know I'm not a fan of Obamacare. I've voted to repeal it 46 times. We actually put a bill this year on the president's desk to repeal it, and he vetoed the legislation. I call it Obamacare because the president has two, so I think that it's an acceptable name for the legislation. I truly believe that people should be in charge of their own health care decisions, and that's not what's happening under this policy. I believe you want to choose your own doctors, you want to be able to shop for policies and pay for provisions that would be utilized by your family, not pay for things that you have no use for. I believe we need new competition in the market, that you should be able to shop anywhere in the country and find a policy that works best for you and your family. One of the provisions we used in South Dakota very effectively was a risk pool. I believe that should be expanded nationwide. I think that medical malpractice reform has to be dealt with because many of the insurance costs that our physicians have are passed on to families in the prices that they deal with when it comes to health care. Everybody that I talk to, in fact, I think on a 99% basis is unhappy with the changes that they've seen. And remember, we've been able to stop many of the most drastic tax increases already.
Thank you. What is your stand on immigration policy, border security, enforcement, and acceptance of refugees? Paula Hawks.
I think we do need extensive immigration reform. We need to protect our security here in the United States, but we also can't turn our back on the fact that immigration is of utmost importance in the United States. People come here looking for a better way of life, looking for that American dream that we all have the opportunity to have. The vast majority of people coming to live in the United States are coming here because they love the United States. They love the ideas and the policies that are here for them, that allow them for opportunities for growth. And so we need to take a look at protecting that. And particularly in South Dakota, where our small businesses, our family farms, our family ranchers depend on immigrant workers to run their businesses, we need to have policies in place that make it safe for them to hire those folks and make it safe for those folks to come here and work. Obviously, national security is also of utmost importance, and so we need a screening process so that we can keep track of folks who come into the country, keep track of them as they leave the country, so that we can protect ourselves while we protect them.
Kristi Noem.
One of the biggest problems we have today is that our president is not enforcing immigration laws. So when you don't enforce the laws of a country, you sure run into a situation where people are not safe. And so I believe that the administration needs to start enforcing the laws that we already have on the books to secure the border, know who's coming into this country, who's leaving this country, and then work on reforming the laws that we currently have in place. Our ag industry is extremely dependent on temporary workers, but their programs are broken, and they're not long-term enough for them to really utilize the year-round help that they need. But also, I think one of the reasons we have so many people coming to this country illegally is because it's almost impossible to come here legally. It takes years and paperwork and often a congressional office to make phone calls on their behalf to make sure that they can go through the legal processes. That's not acceptable. You talked about refugees. We passed a bill that said that there could no longer be a visa waiver program in this country, especially from countries where we have had terrorist threats from and where people have come into this country from. I think it's critically important that we don't allow the administration to waive a vetting process that's critically needed.
Thank you. You both brought up agriculture. What is right and what is wrong with U.S. policies and regulations regarding agriculture, which is our state's largest industry? Paula Hawks.
Obviously, I think that coming from a state like South Dakota, where agriculture is our number one industry, it needs to be the number one priority of our representative in the U.S. House. There are a lot of issues presenting themselves right now in agriculture. We have some of the lowest prices we've seen in years. Rent prices are at the lowest they've been in 26 years. Farm prices, land prices are down. We have a beef industry that is struggling because of the influx of foreign beef. We have lost country of origin labeling. We have lost in CRP funding and allowances. And so these are all issues that hit the industry of agriculture in South Dakota very hard. We need a strong farm bill that is going to protect the interests of small family farmers and ranchers in South Dakota, and that includes reinstating country of origin labeling. That includes broadening that CRP and conservation programs back out. It involves making sure that we're making decisions about agricultural commodities that protect our producers first. And that includes being there at the table to make those decisions for that farm bill.
Christy Noem.
Out of the House of Representatives, there's 435 members. 34 of us are from rural districts. So when I go and visit to these other offices to talk about the importance of passing a farm bill, I explain to them why a farm bill is important. For me, it's a national security issue. It's a food issue. It's a food bill. If we no longer grow our own food in this country and allow another country to provide that food for us, then they control us. So a farm bill's purpose is to have a safety net there. So if we have an economic downturn, low commodity prices, or if we see disasters happen around the country, crop insurance is there to provide that safety net to make sure we don't lose all of our farmers in 1 year. We also have a strong conservation title, but I'm disappointed at the way USDA has implemented the program. And we need to fix that in the next farm bill and have already started on doing that. Having a balance in this policy is critically important to our country's national security, to having a cheap food policy, which is important. Every family in this country should be able to go to the grocery store and be able to afford food for their family. And that's the purpose why you need stability in farm policy.
As the cost of higher education has spiraled in the past decade, student loan debt in the United States has grown to $1.2 trillion. Should access to free public education extend beyond high school, and what, if anything, should the federal government do to address student debt? Paula Hawks.
I think that free public education is probably not the route that we want to go. I think everybody understands that that's not an attainable goal. And frankly, from my perspective, having a daughter who's going to be going into college in the next couple of years, I think it's a really good life lesson for every student to have some amount of ownership in what they do for their higher education. So providing them opportunities and better access to higher education is of utmost importance, but providing it on a free here you go basis is not acceptable. In terms of student loan debt, I have a lot of young friends and several people that I have worked with over the past who are staring down debt so monstrous that they can't even see their way out of it. They're living in their parents' basements. And the federal government's role in that is reversing what has happened over the last couple of years, bringing those interest rates back down to a reasonable level so that kids are not steeped in debt, but see a way out and a light at the end of the tunnel that shows that they are going to be able to repay those debts in a reasonable amount of time.
Christy Noem.
Well, it's a very real conversation in our household. Cassidy paid her own way through college. Kennedy's currently paying her own way through college, and they agonize over every single credit hour and how many jobs they have to do that. So I understand what families go through when they're struggling with these decisions. For me, we've already made some changes that have lowered interest rates and the ability of students to consolidate loans so they pay less interest and are able to do that. In the future, we've tied them to treasury bonds so that it's lower rates for them as they go on and pay off those loans. We've also worked on making sure they have more financial education and decisions on what kind of a job they'll be able to get after they get through college. And to be honest with you, I've tried to focus on making sure that we're serving under-resourced areas and giving students an opportunity to go serve somewhere where we need a physician or a teacher or a doctor. In fact, a key part of my Indian Health Service reform bill says that if you're willing to go provide health care for our tribes, then we'll help you repay your loans. And I think that that also instills in these young people a desire to serve, but also an opportunity to pay off loans when they're done with their education as well.
There are more than 500 federally recognized Indian tribes, including 9 in South Dakota. How do you assess the condition of Indian country, and what do you see as the federal government's proper role in dealing with these sovereign nations and their people? Paula Hawks.
I've made this a major point along my campaign trail as I've crisscrossed South Dakota and visited with the folks on the Indian reservations in South Dakota. The federal government has not just a treaty obligation, but from my perspective, a moral obligation to provide what they have promised for those Native American tribes. When I have gone to talk to those folks in their communities and been a part of the conversation with tribal leaders, their biggest concerns include health care, making sure that the folks on the reservation have good health care and have access when they need it throughout the year. They're concerned about job growth. They're concerned about economic growth. They're concerned about safety and security. And every tribe in this state is concerned about the growing meth problem. And how they're going to deal with that. And so we need to bring them into the conversation. It needs to be a stakeholder decision and a stakeholder conversation about what's going to work, not what we dictate to them, but what they tell us they need and how they can help us accomplish that.
Christine Ohm.
The conditions that our tribes face are really like a third world. And it's the needs that they have are overwhelming. That's one of the reasons why I've worked to put forward a piece of legislation that is a comprehensive reform of Indian Health Services to help meet some of their health care needs. And what that would do would bring more resources in the form of better administrators, better doctors and nurses, but also reforming the formulas for how they get reimbursed for care and how other providers get reimbursed for care when they take care of our Native American people. You know, the challenges are so great. They face a suicide epidemic. They face health needs, food needs, economic needs. On some of our tribes, they have 80% unemployment. So while I think that the federal government has some more commitment it needs to follow through on, in fact, we've increased the budget for Indian Health Services by over $1 billion since I've been in Congress. We still have to make sure there's accountability in these agencies. Because what I see happening too much is the federal government bureaucracy of these agencies that are to provide care and provide education for our tribes haven't done it. It's been neglected and wasted, and that can't continue.
The right to bear arms is guaranteed by the Second Amendment. What, if any, limitations should be placed on the ownership and possession of weapons and ammunition? Paula Hawks.
I'm a hunter and a gun owner here in South Dakota. I've been a part of the hunting culture here for as long as I can remember, from the time I was able to walk alongside the truck and be a spotter. And so I understand and appreciate that culture in South Dakota. I also understand that it's a national security issue. And when we talk about regulations and controls, I don't like a situation where a person on the suspected terrorist list has the ease of achieving weapon ownership in the same capacity that I do. If you're on a suspected terrorist list, I don't believe that you have the right to buy any kind of a weapon without being cleared of that if you're falsely placed on that list. I also believe that common sense goals can be achieved with proper conversation. And those regulations include some kind of background check that allows us to know what it is that those people intend, what it is that they want with those guns. And I have to stop now.
Thank you.
I don't want her coming up here.
Well, you can't buy a gun in this country legally if you're a suspected terrorist. So I think maybe what Paula was referring to was the no-fly, no-buy legislation that we had debated in the House. And what that said was if you were on the no-fly list that you couldn't buy a gun. But really, people get placed on that list wrongly over and over again. And it's a serious thing to take away a constitutional right from someone without due process. So that's the constant battle that we deal with, is protecting constitutional rights. And I take that very seriously. I think we have enough gun laws in this country. And if you look at the violence that we've seen across this country, the vast majority of it has happened because we haven't taken care of people who have mental health issues. And we have a mental health bill that we passed through the House that would bring some needed resources to that area. It would allow families to have information about family members who've confided in doctors that they want to hurt themselves or other people. It would give more information to them and get them more help when they need it so that we can stop these people before they take action and get them the kind of help that they need.
The First Amendment protects five freedoms related to free expression and personal liberties. Is the Bill of Rights too permissive in allowing what some people consider to be offensive, hateful speech and unpatriotic forms of protest, such as flag burning? Paula Hawks.
I think the First Amendment was meant to be slightly permissive and allowing people to say what they believe and giving them the freedom to express their opinions without fear of backlash. And I think that that backlash comes in the form of people holding each other accountable. And I think that that's an effective way of making sure that that is done. When people are offended, and we're seeing this to a great extent with the presidential campaign that we are witnessing right now, people are expressing their their opinions and their lack of acceptance for that in very public ways. And as we have watched the unfolding of social media over the last 5-10 years, we've seen what an influence that has and how people have come to express themselves in a variety of ways, whether we find that acceptable or not. But we can take care of that without federal regulation, I think, and without, you know, taking away strength from the Bill of Rights. We take care of that at an individual level, in a community level, at a church level, and we find ways to express what we find acceptable in acceptable ways.
Christy Noem.
I don't question the Bill of Rights. We have the right to protest as long as that's done peacefully and in a legal manner. And we've seen that happen throughout the country, but here in South Dakota as well. I think it's disrespectful to burn the flag to the men and women who've fought to protect it, to those who it means a lot to, myself included. I think it's disrespectful to kneel for the national anthem and not stand at attention with your hand over your heart. Those are things that I will always try to educate everybody that I meet and I visit with and my children and on why it's important to respect those who defend our country. And so I will always encourage somebody I see protesting in that manner to not do so. But it certainly is something that they have the right to do as long as they're doing it legally and as long as they're doing it peacefully.
Which presidential candidate do you support? And how does that choice align with your values, your policy positions, and your vision for this country? Paula Hawks.
You going to give us 2 minutes on this one, too?
I will.
Oh.
You want 2 minutes?
Ask and you shall receive, huh?
Sure, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Obviously, in this presidential race, we're seeing a lot of vitriol. We're seeing a lot of negative mudslinging. And that's coming from both sides. As far as how my allegiances align and how my philosophy aligns, I don't see anything when I look in the mirror, I see nothing that aligns with Donald Trump. I don't see 100% alignment with Hillary Clinton either. However, I do see somebody who has developed her public policy over decades of service, of public service, not only as a lawyer for nonprofit organizations, doing the best work she can for children across the country, but also as the First Lady of a state and then of the country, the Secretary of State. And I see a lot of her policies lining up with what I see as acceptable. Obviously, there are some areas where I don't agree. My record shows that I have distinct separations from what Hillary Clinton agrees to. I've voted against the Clean Power Plan. I've voted against Waters of the United States. I have a clear record of supporting South Dakota first and making sure that that is my priority. And so when I look at the presidential campaign as it's playing out, I see a display of professionalism from Hillary Clinton. I see from her opponent a lot of negativity, a lot of fear. I see statements that are being made that if my son made, he would get his mouth washed out with soap. I don't want my daughters growing up in a country where that's acceptable and where they should be told, you'd look better on your knees. I think that that's an unacceptable attitude for a person who wants to lead this country. And
so
we need to look carefully at that.
So you are supporting Secretary Clinton?
I am absolutely supporting Secretary Clinton.
Christy Noem.
Well, I think this election has proven to us that we have two very flawed candidates. I plan to vote for Donald Trump. There is not a single thing that Hillary Clinton stands for or believes that makes me or compels me to want to vote for her. And let me explain to you why. When I look at her past 30 years of public service, I'm concerned about many, many of the scandals that have come forward. When I look at the fact that when we were in Libya asking for more security and her State Department did not provide it, that concerns me. When 4 Americans died, she got on TV and lied to the American people about why those attacks happened. When they asked for more help, not a single American asset turned a wheel to help them. I want you to remember that. They never once sent help to prevent those 4 men from dying. And then when those men did die, it was too late. And she didn't apologize to the families. about what did happen or take responsibility for that. I appreciate apologies. You know, I love the Lord and I believe in redemption and that people can change over the years. But when I look at what has come forward with the pay-to-play activities of the Clinton Foundation and how she has used her public office to personally benefit her, her consistent ability to say that she can have a private position on something and a public position on something tells me that she cannot be trusted for what she says when it comes to policies or positions or what she will do for this country. When I look at the families who are struggling, the status quo is not acceptable. Now, we've shown Donald Trump many of the bills that the House Republicans have put forward. My tax reform proposal, he's looked at. He's looked at the RAINS Act, which said these agencies can't put forward major regulations until they come to Congress first. He has said, I will sign those. So if Hillary Clinton ends up being president, boy, am I going to be a check and balance to her administration. If Donald Trump gets elected president, I'm going to send him conservative legislation that he can sign into law. But when it comes to Election Day, I'll be voting for Donald Trump, as those are the only two viable candidates that I have an option today to vote for.
We end this forum with two-minute closing statements in response to this question. In the past hour, we have discussed more than 20 separate issues. Based on what you have expressed and what you have heard from your opponent regarding qualifications, values, philosophies, and policy positions, why should the voters of South Dakota elect you to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives? Paula Hawks.
Thank you, Jack. And again, thank you so much to the Rotary for sponsoring this event today. I think we've had a great discussion of a lot of the issues that are really important, not just in South Dakota, but across the country. In the past 4 years serving in the legislature, I have shown time and again that I am working hard for South Dakota and what is important for South Dakota. From education to agriculture to small businesses, I have voted in the best interests of my constituents and the state of South Dakota. That includes opportunities that I've had to toe the line as far as party loyalty is concerned. Voting in the interest of the consumer rather than in the interest of the Democratic Party. And my bipartisan leadership is clear in not only the legislation that I have brought that has been sponsored by people on the other side of the aisle, prime and co-sponsored, but also in the relationships that I have built that have brought me to this point, and folks who have encouraged me and told me that they support the decisions that I've made and have been behind me on a lot of those issues. We've talked about a lot of issues today, and I think that South Dakota is primed for some change in terms of leadership. And when I go to town halls, some of the biggest concerns that we hear from the folks that attend those town halls have to do with agriculture, have to do with energy production, have to do with job growth and economic stability and maintaining our independence and maintaining our state's rights. And so as we've talked about those, it's clear to me that what we need in the U.S. House is a good, strong voice for agriculture, a good, strong voice for economic growth, a good, strong voice for the middle class. And that's what you will get with me, with a bipartisan attitude going into it, ready to make those conversations happen, ready to develop those relationships that are going to be necessary to move this country forward rather than hold us stagnant and watch as we flail for good policy and good progress.
Kristi Noem.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Jack, for moderating this debate. I think that it was a very good debate, a lot of substance to it, and all of you for being here as well, and Sioux Falls Rotary for hosting it. You know, elections have consequences, and my hope is that we will make the right choice to truly help us put our country back on the track of being successful and giving our children an opportunity to pursue the American dream, much like we had when we were growing up. You know, in South Dakota, we don't run away from problems, we fix them. We pursue opportunities, we don't make excuses. And so it's been a huge honor for me and my family, and frankly, very humbling for us to represent you these last several years. And I would like to ask for your vote in November to represent you again. I'll promise to you that I will be a check and balance to Hillary's administration if she's elected. If it's Donald Trump, I will send him strong conservative legislation that he can sign into law that will make sure that our businesses and our families can be more successful in the future. I've delivered results in a dysfunctional government. I'd love to continue to do that and deliver more and more results for South Dakota that's good for our families, our kids, and our communities. in a government that becomes more and more filled with integrity each and every day. So thank you for all that you do and your opportunity to be here and be a part of this discussion. I think you've seen some differences in policies between us, and we've got a short period of time here before Election Day with some big decisions to be made. But thank you again, and again, I hope I can ask for your support in November. God bless you.
For their participation, their civil and respectful demeanor, and more important, for their commitment and desire to serve our state and nation. Please join me in thanking the candidates, Republican U.S. Representative Kristi Noem and Democratic South Dakota State Representative Paula Hawks.
But wait, there's more. I'm glad you two ate your Wheaties this morning,
yes,
because that was quite a political workout.